Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tech Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have
a
Swangles.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you're watching us on Iconic, Odyssey, Rockfin, Band.video, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you so much. We appreciate your amazing support. You've got 2.8 million other podcast options out there. The fact that you've decided to spend some time with me, we really appreciate it. This show, Macroaggressions, has been the number one show, according to Chartable, in the government section of iTunes in America, Canada, Australia, and 20 other countries. So thank you very much for your amazing support over the, 230 plus episodes that we've been doing this. If you like the episodes, you can share it with your friends and family. That's how it grows. And we certainly do appreciate that. Hey, speaking of appreciation, our sponsors have been with us from the beginning. Thank you so much to C60 Purple Power. Are you familiar with what C60 is? I mean, the guys that invented it won the Nobel Prize for its discovery. It's kind of a big deal. It's the most powerful antioxidant known to man. Most people have never even heard of it before. What it is it's a carbon 60 molecule that looks something like a hollow soccer ball. And they describe it as a free radical sponge. The best thing you can do is to go to shopc60.com and read about it. See what you think. It's really fascinating. It's several hundred times more powerful than any other antioxidant out there. And it gives you cellular protection. And there's a bunch of things that I'm legally not allowed to say that it does, but it does them anyway. Wink, wink. So if you're so inclined, you can go to shopc60.com. Use the promo code MACRO on your way out to save yourself some money and take a look and see what you think. Also, chemical-free body. Listen, we're at a point now where you got to take control of your health as well. A lot of things are out of our control, but I would say this. If you've been putting off getting yourself healthy, the time is now. You really need to have a good talk with yourself and figure out why you're doing this, why you're procrastinating. Start with this. Go to chemicalfreebody.com/macro. There's a 2-minute video that I shot from last summer where Tim James put me through the 90-day detox in a box package. And it was so incredible that I lost, 14 pounds from it, and I wasn't trying to lose weight. That was sort of inadvertent. So it's really important to help. Well, clean yourself out. It's got gut detox, toxin detox, probiotics, ultra enzymes, a couple containers of Green 85. It's really easy to do. You just take mix it up in the morning, slam a drink, take a couple capsules, and that's it. So take a look. See what you think. Chemicalfreebody.com/macro. And on your way out, use the promo code MACRO as well to save yourself some money. All of the links are going to be in the show notes. I don't expect you to have a pen and paper and writing all this down. So if you want to, you can just find the links there and go that direction. But I'm telling you, you want to get yourself prepared physically for what we're going through. We've talked about some of our sponsors in the past that'll get you prepared for other things. So it's about being proactive. And look, considering the topic that we're about to get into, these people are planning ahead. Are you? These people are running simulations. Are you? They're running simulations about what happens when the food supply breaks down. Did you know that? Did you know that they're running Event 201 style drills on what to do when the food system collapses and the supply chain can't handle it? Oh, well, have you heard of food chain reaction? No, probably not. You have now. It's a simulation that took place at the tail end of 2015, and it was simulating a time period from 2020 to 2030, where Agenda 2030 kicks off. I'm sure that's all just a gigantic coincidence that they picked those start dates, right? 2020, when the plandemic started, and 2030, when Agenda 2030 officially hits their benchmark and you eat the bugs or something. According to the simulation, you'll be lucky if there are bugs to eat. That's how bad they say it's going to get. But it's just a simulation. They're just speculating about these things. They're just wondering, well, I wonder what would happen if all of these things, you know, if these stars aligned and the food supply collapsed and then the supply chain broke down and then all these countries had social unrest. I just wonder what would happen. Oh, well, who's in charge of running it? Let's look at who the sponsors are of Food Chain Reaction that happened in December of 2015. The sponsors of this event, Center for American Progress. Oh, that sounds like a good, like a think tank. Yeah, Center for American Progress. Oh, cool. I'm an American. I want to progress. Who's, wait a second. That name sounds familiar. Whose think tank is that? John Podesta's? Oh, shit. Oh, okay. The pedophile guy that ran Hillary Clinton's whole thing. The one who's on that tape of Skippy, where they call him Skip. Oh, that fucking guy. Yeah, he's in charge of this. But don't worry. It gets much worse. I assure you. World Wildlife Fund. Didn't we just talk about this with Maurice Strong and Prince Philip, the founder of the World Wildlife Fund? Remember that? Oh, it's saving the animals, don't you? Look, they've got a panda in their logo. I mean, they're saving the fucking pandas, don't you know? Who started it? Prince Philip? Prince Philip started a charity? The guy that said, when I die, I want to be reincarnated as a deadly virus so I can wipe out humanity? He cares about the animals? Right. Yeah. Then he handed over control of it to Maurice Strong, the godfather of global warming. So listen, don't give your money to World Wildlife Fund. They're a total scam. They're a depopulation outfit. Oh, and by the way, they're one of the sponsors for this. Can't get any worse than that, right? Can it? Well, Cargill is on board. And you go, Cargill? Who's that? I haven't heard. What's an agricultural giant? You know, like Monsanto? It's Cargill. Well, it can't be as bad as Monsanto. Oh, wait, hang on a second. They were voted, quote, the worst company in the world. So the worst company in the world and a charity, and I use that term very loosely, started by Prince Philip and Maurice Strong, and a political action committee started by John fucking Podesta. And now there's a fourth sponsor. Mars Corporation, not the planet Mars, the candy bar Mars. You go, well, Mars, they're just making candy bars, right? They haven't been accused of any fuckery, have they? I mean, just child and slave labor and deforestation in African national parks. But I'll be honest with you. Out of this list of John Podesta, Prince Philip / Maurice Strong, and Cargill, Mars Corporation with their child and slave labor, looking like a pretty good option compared to the rest of them. So the worst people and corporations in the planet have come together to run a simulation about food that's going to go to you, or in this particular case, the food that's never going to get to you. So I think, you know, considering we've got food processing facilities that are just up and exploding when they're not getting hit by random airplanes, which has happened now twice. Supply chain breakdowns, shipping issues in Shenzhen, Hong Kong, Long Beach, Los Angeles. Then we've got an embargo on Russia, so that Russian fertilizer, potash, isn't making its way anywhere else in the world. We have the makings of a ecological food catastrophe here. Not because a solar flare hit the planet or an asteroid came out of nowhere and threw up a trillion tons of debris and blocked out this. None of that stuff. All of these things that we're experiencing right now are completely preventable. They're caused by government interference. So we're looking at a man-made food crisis. But Food Chain Reaction was the conference that they held to get out in front of that, to see what they would do in the event of a catastrophe like this. Just like Event 201. In October of 2019, which 6 months earlier simulated the outbreak of a coronavirus that would sweep the globe and cause massive failures on financial, social, and health aspects. So great. We have this to look forward to. Okay. So this is, I'm going to go over a little bit of the outline to what this is. What actually happened at this event called Food Chain Reaction. It took place over 2 days in Washington, D.C. And I want to tell you who's involved. I'm going to tell you what they simulated. I'm going to tell you what the results were of the simulation when they got done. And then, of course, I'm going to wrap up by telling you why it matters. I think after I explain what happened, you'll pretty much understand why it matters. So the simulation happened in the end of 2015, November, and was predicting events from the years 2020 through the years 2030, a 10-year window. This was for the United States, China, Brazil, India, the continent of Africa, and the European Union. That's the groups it was broken down into. They were testing food system pressure at the intersection of population growth, urbanization, severe weather, and social unrest. And I want, there's a word, or two words in that sentence that I want you to focus on. Population growth. Who did I mention the sponsors were? John Podesta, who is deeply involved in depopulation. Prince Philip, who wanted to come back as a deadly virus and wipe out the world. Maurice Strong, who is the godfather of global warming and a hardcore depopulationist. Cargill, who is making genetically modified foods. And Mars, who is using slave labor. So, depopulation is always at the core. It's the thread running through all of this. Now, they don't come right out and say that, because that would give away their plan. They frame it in a way that, hey, we're just worried about what would happen if the food stopped coming, what that would do to all these poor people out there that we're trying to keep alive. Wink, wink. They're trying to figure out how long it'll take to kill a bunch of people. That's what's actually happening. That looks bad on paper. They shut you down when you hold simulations talking about how to kill a bunch of people. It's called premeditated mass murder. So you have to frame it differently. And so let's do this. I'm going to start by going to the abstract. This is what the paper, you can find this, by the way, Food Chain Reaction. Just look this up. It's called A Global Food Security Game. There's a 47-page PDF that will explain all of this. I read it so that you don't have to. I've got 7 pages of notes on it. I feel like Alex fucking Jones with my doc. Turn on the document cam. Got all these papers here. Okay, here's the abstract. I'm just going to read it. So, the Center for American Progress World Wildlife Fund, Cargill, Mars, and CNA. CNA is the company that put this whole document together, developed and executed a policy decision-making game designed to explore issues arising from and possible responses to global food system disruptions. The game took place in November 2015 in Washington, D.C., and included senior officials and subject matter experts on teams representing Brazil, continental Africa, China, the European Union, India, the United States, multilateral institutions, and business and investors. I'll explain what those are in a second. During four rounds of gameplay spanning the decade 2020 to 2030, players confronted food system pressure at the intersection of population growth, urbanization, severe weather, and social unrest. In response, players crafted policies, made decisions, and took actions that dynamically influenced the state of the world as the game advanced. As the chain reaction of impacts tied to their choices became apparent, players experienced firsthand how their decisions and actions influenced global food security. At the conclusion of the game, players highlighted significant lessons learned and expressed increased preparedness to collaboratively address food security. So, this is what they did. They put them through four rounds. The first round was 2020 to 2021. So we've already, in real life, passed this. But I think you'll find it interesting to see where they were there and see where we go. Second round is 2022, the year of where I'm currently recording this, to 2024. That's second round, 2022 to 2024. Third round is 2025 to 2027, and the fourth and final round is 2028 to 2030. You don't need to take notes on any of this. I'll explain it. So, will increasing levels of stress on the global food system disrupt markets? Will individual nations become isolationist or cooperate to restore stability? Will global leaders identify new and innovative approaches to balance short and long-term considerations? So this is what they said. We're going to get all you people involved in this conference, all these eight different groups, and we're going to throw variables at you. We're going to say, this is the scenario currently in 2020, and this is what's happening. And then after you go through that first round, which is 2020 to 2021, they're going to then reassess. They're going to throw new variables. They're going to say, well, news has come out that this has happened. And then they're going to, when they go into the second round, they're going to have to make decisions that sort of based on the information they have. When they get done with that, they'll be told new news for the third round. Right before the third round starts, they'll have to make adjustments again. And then again, before the start of the fourth round. So they're just trying to get people thinking about, if this happens, what is your reaction to it as a country? What is your reaction to it? As an international community, what is your reaction to it? How can, will China and Brazil and the United States in this scenario work together to help solve this? Or will they say, we got our own problems and become isolationists and say, you guys stay out. We have food here. We're going to just keep growing it. We're not going to deal with you. So what are we going to do? This was the plan. So they brought in 65 global thought leaders, whatever that means, were brought in. This was November 9th and 10th of in 2015. They're experts in agriculture, trade, economics, climate / environment, diplomacy, and security. And during the event, players encountered a decade marked by food price increases, supply chain swings, population growth, rapid urbanization, severe weather events, and social unrest. Or another way to put that is the year 2021, basically. All these things happen and continue to happen. It's almost like they have a crystal ball. It's all, like, if I didn't know any better, I'd say they might be making this stuff happen, but that would make me a conspiracy theorist. And we can't have that because I'll get banned on Twitter for wrong thing. So they organize these into great team, into eight different teams: Brazil, China, EU, India, US, Africa, and then business and investors and multilateral institutions. I said I would explain what that means. So business and investors, they brought in like the BlackRocks of the world to sit there, and venture capital guys that would say, yeah, you in round two, you finally decided that you wanted to innovate on your crop production capacities and you have some good ideas. That's something we have. We're the business and investor group, and we could definitely make something work with you. We'd be willing to come in, kick in some money, and maybe help you create companies that can, you know, develop new methods that aren't currently available to automate food production or whatever. So that's the business and investors. The multilateral institutions is a nice word for the worst institutions. This is the World Bank, the United Nations, and NGOs are sitting in this basket of groups called the multilateral institutions. So what happens is they take the first, there's eight groups total, but business investors and multilateral institutions kind of sit off to the side, and they let these other countries, these other teams, they put them in a room, each in their own room. They tell them what the scenario is. They make them start working on it together. They make that country, Brazil, just work with the Brazilian team and try to figure out what they want to do. And then after that, at some point, they're allowed to reach out to the other teams and say, hey, we'd like to do a deal with China for this, or we'd like to cut a deal with, you know, can we bring in the investors? And, you know, we have an idea we want to run by them. So this is kind of how the scenario worked over the course of 2 days. So first round, let's start round one. Ding, ding, ding. This is 2020 to 2021. Now, remember, they're predicting this 4 years in advance, or roughly. So the tail end of 2015, they're predicting this for the beginning of 2020, otherwise known as COVID season. What we've just gone through the last 2 years, that's the first round. So before that, they predicted that during COVID season, we would have lower than average global food stocks, rising food prices, weather-related disasters, and instances of social unrest. They should have been buying lottery tickets too, because they seem to be right over the target. Okay. Second round, 2022 to 2024, food security crisis peaks. Almost like what we're experiencing right now, or what we're about to experience. Third round, there's the lowering of global pressure, so things start to calm down a bit. And then in the fourth round, tight global circumstances, just like round one. So it just goes right back up again. So what they want to do is they want to get these people, they want to see how these countries are going to react. Are they quick to react? Are they slow to react? Are they quick to work together? Or do they not take this seriously until it's too late? So one of the early conclusions is that they use this term, so you know it's a scam when you hear this term. Stakeholder corporations. You hear stakeholder, you know it's ESG, World Economic Forum, globalism. All right, so, and it's a giant scam, because you're not going to have a stake in this. Stakeholder cooperation and collaboration are paramount to the development of effective short and long-term food security initiatives. Okay, that's one early conclusion. So, game findings. Round one. What happened after round one in this simulation? Well, nobody did much of anything. They didn't take it seriously. They went, doesn't seem like that big of a deal. We're not really concerned about it. They finally started taking action in round two, once there were multiple weather events that were told to them by the people running the show here. There were multiple weather events. There was record low food stocks. There were record high food prices, like kind of where we're going now. There was social unrest, and there was a humanitarian need. So once they got that message in round two, they were like, oh shit, we better do something about this. refugee movement contributed to the global conflict? George Soros? Anyone? Anyone? Refugee movement contributed to chaos? Color me surprised. You mean like what he did in North Africa, moving them through Turkey? You mean that? Or the refugee crisis that's coming up through Central America into the southern border of the United States that's being financed by George Soros? Again, just a huge coincidence that they're role-playing this. They claim that the participants left the event excited about the importance of proactive, cooperative, and balanced approaches to promoting global food security. That's what they said. Okay. Okay, I'm going to read a quote. This is from Derek Headley and Shenzhen Fan Food Policy Research Institute. Quote, "The most daunting aspect of the existing global food system is not only the strong possibility that food crises are an inherent aspect of the global food system, but also that this system may well be hit hard by several shocks in the future. These include adverse weather shocks and declining productivity related to climate change, and a reoccurrence of oil price shocks and surging biofuel demand." Again, you're going to notice a theme, and it's red flashing lights when you see it, but they're going to do a lot of talking about climate change. If you're new to this show, I suggest going back and listening to some of my other episodes about climate change, about what this scam is. It's not a real thing. Pollution is real. I want to be crystal clear. There's pollution going on. We've got to stop that. We've got to stop treating this beautiful planet like a dumping ground, okay? But that's not climate change. That's not what they're talking about. Atmospheric carbon levels. And so there's a couple of things that make me wonder where this is going. When I hear stakeholder and when I hear climate change, I know I'm dealing with a scam. It's just, what's the parameters of this scam? I'm interested, but I'm not falling for it. But I don't have to fall for it to still want to read and understand how it works, because I want to know what they're saying to one another. I want to know how they're selling this scam. Because once again, when I see the United Nations, the World Bank, and a bunch of NGOs involved, I know it's a scam. So this is how countries played their hands. Okay, I'm going to go through each of the six countries and or country groups and explain what the results were after this game started. So starting with Brazil, there was very little disagreement in the group. Okay, they all got along well. When there was an issue, they sorted it out. There wasn't much fighting going on. They were focused on growth-oriented domestic policies. Brazil has obviously a ton of land and a great place to grow food. So they felt insulated from significant food security issues. They felt insulated because they have access to a ton of food. And if you're a country that does have access to a ton of food, you were one that didn't really move super quickly. You weren't first to identify this as being a gigantic crisis, because it wasn't to you, because you still had food. But when you're continental Africa, you and you're not developed in a way that provides that. I mean, obviously we know that Africa has a food problem and has for a long, long time. We can debate that about why that is, and it's not authentic, it's artificially happening, but regardless, that so Africa would be, as an example, quicker to notice that there was a food issue than Brazil, because Brazil was growing their own food. They pushed biofuels. Brazil pushed biofuels to reduce climate impact. Biofuels are like ethanol made from corn, which is, it's just dumb. It's just a dumb choice of fuel, of an alternative fuel. It's like, hey, let's take this food and turn it into fuel. Well, what do you need, food or fuel? It's like, well, I need both. All right, well, fine. Then don't turn the food into fuel if you're also going to need the food. And I recognize there's different types of corn and some of it isn't really edible, but still, the ground in which you're growing this you could be using it for something else. So Brazil went ahead and invested in domestic research for agri improvements, like new fertilizers. They were willing to sign multilateral agreements instead of bilateral actions. So they were willing to work with a lot of the other groups. They could do a deal, a three-team trade, if we want to get sportsy about this. So Brazil was open to that. Okay. Now there's China. Let's talk about China. No internal conflict due to consistent viewpoints. There's not a whole lot of divergent thought in China, at least at the government level, which is what you're dealing with here, bureaucrats. So they were focused on national self-sufficiency because since they have a huge population, they explained that they believe being self-sufficient actually helped the rest of the world by default. Because as long as China, with their, let's just call it 2 billion people, as long as China could provide for their 2 billion people, then the other countries didn't have to help out to provide for China's 2 billion people. So what China's approach to this was, by us focusing on our own domestic issues, by default, we are helping the international community because it's one less problem you have to worry about. And considering we've got like 25% of the world's population and we are talking about food, then just know that we're prioritizing domestic issues and you don't have to worry about us. Now, the rest of the international community was like, well, you have to deal with us and everything. But I understand where China's coming from on this. It's not an unrealistic way of looking at things. Okay, they were focused heavily on water resource strategy, such as irrigation, pollution, contamination control, and desalinization. They were willing to invest in Africa in this scenario because they're willing to invest in Africa in real life. As I've said before, China builds hospitals for sick Africans. America builds graveyards for dead Africans. That's what we do there, especially in North Africa. They were reluctant to being transparent about food stock levels. Really? China was reluctant to be transparent? At least they were honest. They were cooperative in Southeast Asia with solar and hydroelectric power source development. I think they saw that as being in their best interest as well, to be cooperative with Southeast Asia. Because, look, if you've got a catastrophe happening in a neighboring country, you know that those refugees will come to your country. So if you want to protect yourself, sometimes one of the best things you can do is help out your neighbors so that your neighbor doesn't turn into a third world hellscape and all those people are looking to leave there and come to your place. If you really are like China and you don't want them in, help out Southeast Asia and say, fine, you guys are having problems. We'll help with solar and hydroelectric power, especially hydroelectric power, since so many of the rivers from China flow down into Southeast Asia. And so they're all connected in that sense. So plus China was also cooperative with sharing their use of artificial rainfall technology. That's just a conspiracy theory, you say. They can make it rain or make it not rain on opening night of the Olympics, as they did in Beijing. Next group, Africa. There were challenges working together due to so many countries with different interests. This is, of course, this is kind of an obvious one, too. They group this continental Africa together. But let's be fair, there's 40 plus countries inside of Africa. Not all of them want the same thing. Not all of them are economically sound. Not all of them have the same topography and geography and the ability to grow food. And some of them have water. Some of them do not. They're all different. So the only thing they have in common is that they're sharing the continent of Africa. But besides that, they're very fragmented. So there were challenges in getting so many of these countries to come together and work as one. But they did describe Africa as the breadbasket of the future, committed significant resources to climate smart initiatives, and encouraged foreign direct investment and trade. They pushed for free trade within Africa. They said, listen, we've got all these, Africa's massively big. It's so much bigger than we're shown on the maps. It's so big you could fit the United States, China, and India all inside of Africa. So it's a massive place. And what they're saying is, we want free trade within Africa. We've got all these borders everywhere, all these countries, but we want at least, maybe in general, but specifically for the food component of this, we want to be able to have everybody be able to freely trade with each other without a whole bunch of hangups and paperwork and bureaucracy. And on top of that, they said, we want foreign direct investment in Africa. We're open for business. So if you guys want to invest money, be that the corporation team, be that the NGO, World Bank, IMF, United Nations team, or China, or United States, whoever, Africa was letting people know they were ready for that. They pushed economic transformation through raising capital. They entered into negotiation with the business and investors team, the USA team, the India team, and the China team. And they called on other countries slash teams to avoid trade restrictions. They want real free market, or as free as you can get. Next on the list, European Union. Lots of internal debate. The team allocated 40 million euros for, quote, rewards to agricultural producers engaged in good environmental behavior. There's nothing inherently wrong with that, as long as we get a definition of what good environmental behavior means, because something tells me when the United Nations and the IMF and the World Bank are involved, that good environmental behavior means genetically modified crops and borrowing money from the World Bank. So we'll see. The European Union taxed meat during the peak of food crisis. Okay. They invested in research and development towards sustainable productivity in low-income countries through development financing and infrastructure investment. Oh, you mean like when you colonize the world through Great Britain? Like that sort of we're coming to invest in low-income countries through development financing. Oh, you mean enslaving them through financing? Not high-income countries, low-income. You want to get the poor enslaved in your scam. I mean, something tells me that London was involved in this. I'm just saying. I recognize it was European Union, which doesn't currently include London, but you get the point. They joined other teams in support of carbon pricing. Ding, 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 ding. Carbon trading, ding, ding, and a global emissions cap. We're going to get into that later, but hint, I'm going to give you a little hint. That's what the whole thing's about. They considered criminalizing food waste. Good Lord. Could you imagine if they criminalized food waste in the United States of America? You know how much food gets wasted here? It's a fucking abomination. Meat tax, carbon tax for agricultural production based on emissions impact. This is the European Union. They encourage multilateral institutions, this is the World Bank and the United Nations group, leadership in land tenure rights and contract transparency initiatives. Okay. The EU just can't resist. They just can't get away from their roots of colonizing country. I mean, the minute they saw that Africa was involved, I swear to God, they said, let's colonize it. Oh, we're going to get the United Nations involved. This is what the EU wanted. They said, we want to get the United Nations group involved in land tenure rights, contracts, laws about who owns the land, and contract transparency initiatives. Oh, I'm sure that transparency is only one way. You know, I'm sure that it's only transparent on one side of the equation. I'm sure nobody's. This is how you take over the world. They're trying to do this. And of course, they want the United Nations. And of course, they want the World Bank involved. So the European Union gets a big fat F on this thing. But I don't think anyone was surprised. Let's move on to India. India, they fought with each other for 6 hours, screaming and throwing chairs. No, I'm kidding. They didn't. But have you ever seen Indian TV, by the way? Have you ever seen those news shows on Indian TV? Kev Baker and I used to watch. He would send me these clips to General Bakshi, and it would just, and it's just, you think of like Meet the Press or when MSNBC has like four or five people on for like a panel discussion. Picture them all just simultaneously screaming at each other at the top of their voice and you can't hear anybody. That's Indian TV. So that's when they got them all in the room. They said they had a little trouble getting along. Really? The Indians had a little trouble all getting along and not screaming. I made up the part about throwing chairs and screaming, but they did have a problem getting along there. Just in my head, it's General Bakshi going, "You goddamn motherfucker, I fucking kill you." They used revenues from coal taxation to develop domestic capacity and improve infrastructure for India's 4,000 market towns. Market towns are like large farmers markets, and there's thousands of them in India. And so what they did was they said, look, we like that we have these 4,000 market towns for food. It's part of how India's culture is set up. And what we want to do is we're going to tax coal, the coal revenues from coal, and I don't know if that means, you know, burning coal or mining coal or both, but they're going to tax coal to develop and improve the infrastructure inside these 4,000 market towns. I think it's probably, I mean, I hate taxation, of course, but if you're taxing it to use it for your military, you're awful. But if you're taxing it to help to develop the farmer markets in these market towns, I think you're probably on the right track, especially when you're India and you've got 1.5 billion people there. You probably need to make sure that you've got your food supply chain as buttoned up as you can. They joined other teams in support of a global emissions cap. So, you know, India's playing ball with the globalists. They partnered with China to manage shared water resources like rivers. They released a portion of their domestic food stock to relieve short-term global shortages, which was nice of them. They asked China to do the same thing, and China said no. They advocated for climate-smart agriculture, research and development like climate-tolerant seed varieties, such as you would find in genetically modified seeds. Yikes. They committed to share intellectual property with Africa. Pretty nice of them. China committed to stealing all the intellectual property from everybody. Not really, but I'm sure they did. Proposed creation of a global food bank and establishment of the Order for Response to Disaster and Emergency Relief. Acronym for that is ORDER. You know, like the New World Order. They wanted this Organization for Response to Disaster and Emergency Relief to be non-military and humanitarian, as a disaster relief organization that would serve as a coordinating mechanism to address climate change-induced disasters. Think of FEMA, but for India. That's what they wanted, okay? Because FEMA is so successful. United States. What were the takeaways from the United States? Okay. Minimal internal conflict. They did not throw chairs and yell at each other. And to be clear, India didn't either. I was just kidding. Established global consortium on agricultural research and development, and convinced other teams to pay for it. Isn't that the most American thing ever, that they established this global consortium on agricultural research and development? They're like, yeah, that sounds great. Who's going to pay for it? Them. Not us. We're broke. We've done put enough wars on our credit card. Our Amex bill is maxed out. So, sorry, your global consortium on agricultural research and development is going to have to be paid for by somebody else. How about the IMF and World Bank pay for it? Those bastards. All right. Promote the UN's Global Summit on Climate Security and Vulnerability to address security, diplomacy, and the implications of climate-related disasters on vulnerable nations. probably so that they can invade them later. They want to have, they want to know who is the most vulnerable nations to this climate impact. And then they want to have the United Nations Global Summit on Climate Security and Vulnerability, do something about it. I'm sure they'll do something about it too, considering the United Nations is a world government pushing body that was started by David Rockefeller. The United States is like, let's just have the UN figure out which country is the most vulnerable to all this climate stuff. And then we'll just go tell them that we're going to help them. Meanwhile, we'll just send in USAID and National Endowment for Democracy and just do a regime change operation under the guise of saving them from a climate catastrophe. And next thing you know, we'll be, everybody will be putting whatever that country's flags in their Twitter bio. So they advocated for this is the United States still, their group. They advocated for initiatives promoting women farmers. Okay. Committed to domestic emissions reduction targets and urban agriculture. Urban agriculture is probably something we should be doing anyway. Growing your own food as much as you can, tearing up our front lawns and planting gardens there. I know that gives homeowners associations a heart attack, but fuck homeowners associations. And let's see what else. They realigned domestic funding sources to create Climate Investment Fund. The United States is so concerned that they want to create a climate investment fund. The United States Infrastructure and Climate Smart Development Bank is what they want. Look, if your proposed solution to any problem is to build a bank, it is not a solution. I'm just telling you that right now. Banks are the problem, not the answer. Okay. They wanted to do this. They wanted to create this, the American group, U.S. Infrastructure and Climate Smart Development Bank, targeting overseas climate smart agriculture and development initiatives. They want a bank with a bunch of money that they can give to all these other countries to help them develop development initiatives, which is code for privatize your industry and let our bank buy it from you. And they promote the American group wanted to promote diet shifts away from meat. I know you're shocked. I mean, it's not like we've been talking about what Klaus Schwab and the boys are saying, you'll eat the bugs, or, you know, meat is really bad for you. Or that fucking maniac that was on a panel discussion, who is that scientist guy who's saying, oh, you know, we found a tick, and when they bite you, then you just totally lose the taste for meat. And we were thinking maybe we could put that in a vaccine and give it to people so that we, you know, they eat less meat. And he was like, isn't that great? And everyone's like, you need to be locked up for the rest of your life. You're a sociopath. Next group, this is the business and investor group. Okay, so this is it's not regional, though they tend to pool for almost all in North America. So minimal internal conflict because it was almost entirely comprised of North American entities that are looking to make a lot of money in the climate scam. So they'll work together. They recognize when they see a multi-trillion dollar opportunity, they'll put their differences aside. The business and investors, they want global food security information to be improved. They want data. They want measures of food stocks and flows. They want to know what each one of these countries has in their food reserves. How much do you have hiding? How much have you squirreled away? China said, we're not telling you. India was like, we'll tell you what we've got. Brazil was like, we'll tell you what we've got. America was like, well, we don't have anything. But China was like, we're not telling you. The business and investors were like, in order for us to work with you, we're going to need to know how much food you've actually got. So they wanted improved forecasts of potential shortages. And they wanted private company data that they promised to keep private. Okay. They were big promoters of GMO crop development. What a surprise. They want GMO seeds accepted What's interesting about this, China said no. In this simulation, China said no to GMO food. And that's because of the golden rice controversy that they had. Oh, I want to say it's probably 15 years ago in the Philippines, Southeast Asia in general, but Philippines in particular, golden rice was this GMO rice that was going to like increase the rice yields, and it was going to bring all these people out of poverty. It destroyed their rice producing capability. It never produced what they said it was going to. It was a failure. Because it's genetically modified organisms, and these GMO seeds are no bueno. And China was like, we don't want any involvement with GMO seeds due to the golden rice fiasco of a decade or so ago. So when I read that, I knew what it means because I knew about golden rice. But if you don't know, I mean, there's nothing golden about it unless you're Monsanto or Cargill, who also is involved in genetically modified seeds. The United States and Brazil said yes to GMOs. India and Africa, they said maybe to GMOs. Okay. But the business and investor group really wanted to push GMOs. Wonder why. Because there's money in those seeds, whereas there's no money in natural organic seeds. Or very, very little money. There's no ability to patent the seeds, I should say. So I shouldn't say there's no money in it. There's just not the sort of money that's in patenting the seeds. The business and investors wanted a reduction of barriers to trade. That's in line with what Africa wanted. They were concerned about the security of private investments in areas of regional instability, e.g. fertilizer. Whoa, you mean like Russia? You mean like you're concerned about private investments? What if you're a Cell Partners, a venture capital firm in Silicon Valley, and you make a big investment in a Russian potash company that's making fertilizer, and all of a sudden there's sanctions created by this fucking Ukraine thing that's going on. And so now all of a sudden you're not allowed to interact with Russia. What the business and investor group is saying, hey, look, we have concerns about this. If we're going to get involved with our money and our investment, we need to know that you're not just going to pull Russia on us and shut us out, right? So they were concerned about water availability. They agreed to share technology to improve water efficiency in irrigation. They partnered with multilateral institutions, that is the IMF, World Bank, NGOs, to increase capacity for food delivery to targeted hotspots. So targeted hot... In the context of the United Nations, when you're using the term targeted hotspots, what that means is that's a country that is either in the middle of being regime changed or is in the middle of a civil war that's being financed by the World Bank or something like that. The business and investor group said, we want to partner with the UN to increase our capacity to deliver food into these targeted hotspots that they identify. So. All right. And last on this list is the multilateral institutions, IMF, World Bank, NGOs. The reason why I say that is because multilateral institutions is the name they gave for it, which is a very like whitewashed name. It doesn't really jump out and scream evil, but it is if you've got the United Nations involved. So that's why I keep mentioning that. So the UN group said... They had challenges achieving internal harmony due to diversity of players. There were too many cooks in the kitchen in the multilateral institutions room because the development banks, the United Nations, the NGOs, they all wanted a little something different. And so getting them all to agree on what that was a bit of a challenge, but they ultimately figured it out because at their core, they're about depopulation, carbon taxes, and one world government. So as long as you get those three things right, then they'll get on board with it, but they were bickering about other things. Ultimately, They assume the role as, quote, trusted partner capable of facilitating conversation among nations, United States, the room with the U.S. and the room with China, as an example. This group, this United Nations group, would go visit with China and talk to them. Hey, what are you guys seeing? Oh, well, we want to do this. And then they'd go over to America, you know, the USA team. And they'd say, well, what are you looking? They say, well, we could do this. And say, oh, we should put you in touch with China. What if we went to China and we told them that you wanted to do this? And so they go over there and it's like they're passing notes to each other and, you know, in class or whatever. So that's what they did. They committed to significant investments for climate smart agriculture and fisheries. There's no surprise there. They want to create a new international institution for food, water, and climate. We'll get to that in a minute. It's every bit as devious as you would suspect it would be. They want the UN to run, quote, whole system approaches to fighting climate change and sustainable development goals. That's the point of this whole thing. What they really want, what this group really wants, is they want for everyone to get on the same page and look to the United Nations, the World Bank, the IMF, and those NGO partners to run the whole system and tell them what to do under the guise of fighting climate change and sustainable development goals. Because if there's one thing we know about the United Nations, they just really want to fight climate change because they care about you so much, you know, as they're working to depopulate the planet right before our eyes. Okay, so next section is called observations. And for observations, this is a quote from what's described as adjudication cell member. It's one of the people that was working on this project. Quote, the problems are getting worse. The actions remain static. That is as bad as you can get. So round one. So this is what happened in round one. Round one, again, the years 2020 to 2021, the two COVID years, okay? Teams focused on domestic action, but really did nothing but identify goals. They just worked on themselves and they said, we'll set some goals, but we're not going to do anything together. They kept a business as usual mentality. So what we learned from this is that when the food crisis starts to kick in, like now in real life, these countries, business investor guys, and the UN groups, they didn't take it seriously. It took them a couple years before they even did anything about it, like kind of what we're experiencing now. So they weren't proactive. They were reactive. We've talked about this a lot on this show about, like, you see this insanity unfolding in front of you. You have some decisions to make. Are you going to just pretend like it's not happening, or are you going to recognize it, be proactive, and make some moves in advance and put yourself in a better situation so that this, whatever this new thing is, doesn't impact you so badly? The governments, they didn't do that. They were reactive. They were not proactive. So in round one, they did nothing. They had a business as usual mentality. What a surprise. Round two, though, that's 2022, current year now, to 2024. So we've got a 3-year window here. Tipping point forced teams to actually do something, causing more innovation and aggressive engagement. Basically, they woke up and started to take it seriously. You know, it takes record high food prices, it takes social unrest, and it takes the supply chain to literally break down before these countries decided, hey, maybe we should actually do something about this problem that we've caused, lest we be run out of town with torches and pitchforks. So they finally decided to try and do something about it. Round three, 2025 to 2027. Again, a couple years in here. Things calm down a bit for round three, but the teams worked hard on initiatives to build resilience and prepare for future challenges. Okay, so things started to calm down a little bit, but the teams still stayed like they had been awakened to like, oh, we should probably button up this supply chain issue. We should probably make sure that we're going to have enough food to last us. Yeah, things are getting better, but we just went through a couple year period where things were really bad. This could happen again. Maybe we'll use this downtime to innovate, improve our technology, and basically make sure that this doesn't happen again. So in round three, that's what they did. Then round four came. They cranked that shit right back up. And when things got bad again, the teams now became action-oriented from the onset. So for round four, 2028 to 2030, the teams were like ready for it. Okay. They had been planning. They recognized that this was a possibility, that they could have these water issues and food issues and supply chain issues and fertilizer issues and all this stuff. They realized that they'd been dealing with it for the past, you know, 8 years or so in the simulation. And they said, we're not going to let this happen again. We're prepared. Okay. So the teams came. So this is where we've got a little bit more to get to, but the teams came to the same globalist conclusion that they always come to. We've read a couple of these simulations before. We've read quotes from people that are talking, at the Club of Rome. We've talked to people at the United Nations. There's a certain way that they frame things when they're talking about it that is very familiar running through all of these statements. And this scenario is no exception to it. So I'm going to read the quote from it. And then you tell me if this sounds kind of familiar. If you've listened to some of the episodes before, you've heard me mention this before. Quote, no one organization, business, or nation could successfully address global food security. This revelation drove more robust international cooperation and collaboration. Final round of play culminated in the convening of a global summit on climate security and vulnerability, during which reps of all teams expressed the desire for a more robust global coordination mechanism with greater capacity to respond to climate-related conflict and food system volatility. That's the quote. This is what I was talking about. This is that theme that's running through this. Oh, this problem is so big that just one nation could never figure this out. We're going to need several nations. We're going to need United Nations in order to tackle this problem. A problem this large is just no match for one country. Really, what we need is all of the countries working together under the global coordination of the United Nations. A one world government, if you will. That's the theme. Whenever you hear them talking about this problem is just so much bigger than one nation. Pollution? Climate change? Oh, climate change. It can't just be sorted out by China changing their ways. We have to all change our ways. We have to collectively, all of the countries of the world have to come together to fight this one invisible enemy that's out there that's going to get it, whether it be terrorism or climate change or carbon or imaginary food crisis that they're cooking up or whatever. We've got to all come together in a one world government. That's the only way we can fix this, right? All right. The link between climate and food security was the main idea that they all recognized, okay? But in addition, teams agreed to the following. Remember when I said that this is a scam? Not the idea that there's going to be food insecurity. That's very real. But like I said, it's created by governments and trade issues and the government paying farmers to not farm or burn their crops or plow over their fields or whatever. I mean, all that stuff is the sort of government tinkering that happens that creates the scenarios in which you wind up with food shortages. It's not happening. Like I said, it's not happening because we got hit by a comet. It's happening because we got hit by government. But it's interesting. You can't get any of these eight groups to agree on much of anything, right? Except for this. This is what they agreed on. Four things. To price environmental services, to price carbon, to support the development of a market for carbon trading, and to cap global emissions levels by 2030. Cap and trade. What have I been saying? What have I been saying about this carbon tax hustle? That's what climate change is about. It's about a carbon tax. It's about creating an imaginary line that says anything above this, you're beyond the allocation of carbon that you're allowed to emit into, pollute into the world. Mind you, trees and plants live on carbon, but carbon dioxide, it's plant food, but we've decided that that's the enemy. So carbon is the enemy. Anything over this amount, we're going to punish you. We're going to tax you on it. We're going to set a cap. Then we're going to allow you to price the carbon. Then we're going to allow you to trade the carbon, which is exactly what Maurice Strong was teaching Ken Lay and Al Gore. There it is. This is the outcome that they wanted. Problem, reaction, solution. Problem. We have a food crisis. Reaction. Oh shit, we're all going to die. Solution. We have to price carbon. We have to develop a market for carbon trading, and we have to cap global emissions of carbon. Solution. That's it. That's what it's about. Teams entered into negotiations regarding, number one, a global carbon cap. Number two, carbon taxes. Number three, carbon shadow pricing through regulations. Number four, carbon trading. That's it. We found it. I went through 47 pages to find the smoking gun. That's it. It's all about carbon. It's all about carbon tax credit marketplaces. This is going to make central banking look like monopoly money, which it is monopoly money. It's going to make it look like an amateur scam when they get done with this. None of the teams focus much on water and energy or the water food security relationship, which is unusual considering food needs water to grow in almost every case. They focused on carbon instead. They didn't focus on water. They focused on carbon. They wanted more data on everything like food demand, water availability and rights, food security, nutrition and food access, and infrastructure. More data. They wanted more data, especially the business development team and investor team. Okay, so let's wrap it up with this. All teams agreed to the general framework of key initiatives, such as strengthening existing institutions under the United Nations, such as World Food Program, World Health Organization, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the Department of Peacekeeping Operations. Mind you, these are all the departments underneath the United Nations. World Food Program, World Health Organization, Food and Agriculture Organization, Department of Peacekeeping Operations, Office of the High Commissioner for Refugees, and the International Fund for Agricultural Development, all through the United Nations. They didn't agree on jack shit, except for this, that the United Nations should run it. And should under all these programs. This is number two, the second thing they agreed on. Establish a new coordinating entity under the United Nations and G20 to respond in a more timely way. They said they want the UN and the G20 nations to create a new organization so that can be the group that next time we have food insecurity, supply chain issues, that group is in charge of it. What could possibly go wrong, right? The G20 nations and the UN creating a new group to fuck you in new ways that you've never dreamed of? Can't wait for that one. And lastly, they agreed to create a new strategic headquarters under the direction of the United Nations, again, to better coordinate, I can't even believe this, military and non-military assets and prepositioned materials in areas of anticipated need. They all agreed on a United Nations-led World Army for Climate Change. You should be terrified of what these people are planning. It's not about food. It's about control. It's not about science. It's about compliance. It's about a carbon tax that the United Nations is in charge of. They laid it all out. Couldn't agree on anything except those three things that the United Nations needs to be involved. Just another one of these scenarios that they're running in advance. And then, oops-a-daisy, looks like they wound up happening almost exactly as, well, at least the early stages, as they've predicted. So you can get ready for it. If you are so inclined, you can go look up the food chain reaction scenario, read it for yourself, see what you think. Hey, if you like this episode, you can take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. They're never going to hear this information on the nightly news, I assure you of that. You can follow me on Twitter at Macroaggression. You can connect with me through the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com, and I will talk to you all later.